Blog Talk Radio.
Everybody's got the fever. This is something we all know. Fever isn't such a new thing. Fever started long ago. Never know how.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to Lenny Gottfried's Straight No Chaser. I am so excited this evening about your guests that I have for you this evening. You talk about a power couple, but we'll get to that in a few minutes. You know what I first do immediately all the time? The thing that I do is I always want to do a little housekeeping. So I want to tell you that you are on blogtalkradio.com/ S as in Fred, S as in Sam, F as in Fred, T as in Tom, H as in Harry, and the number 2. And if you want to dial in and say hello to these wonderful people today, ask a question in our conversation, you dial 516-453-6063. And if you want to be on the air to ask them, you hit the number 1. All right? Now, that's our housekeeping for right now. You know that my conversations have always surrounded about the arts and how the arts have influenced the lives of everyone in our society, not just artists, but everyday people. But this evening, I've been really blessed to have a couple, an empowered couple, that how gracing my airways, and I'm going to be talking to them as a couple for the first time. So I'm going to be discovering everything with you at the same time. I'm so excited. Let me start with the powerhouse female, and then I'll go to what I call the gentleman Tony Award winner. All right? Let's start with Jennifer Rivoy. I am so tired of her. I'm so sick of what this woman has done with her life. I can't wait to ask her 1,000 questions. But she is a artist, she's a lyricist, she's an author, a playwright, she's traveled all over the place, she's lived so many places, she's written a play that this is my first time really encountering in it, and I really have to talk about it, and it is The Women of Lockerbie. I have to talk about it. The whole premise of it is absolutely fabulous. She knows people that I know, and I've been hearing so many wonderful things about her, so she is the award-winning, wonderful Deborah Rivoy. Now, she is married to the award-winning, Tony Award-winning Chuck Cooper, who is absolutely fabulous and who got his Tony, you know, in, I believe it was 1997, for the role of Memphis in The Life and has been on Broadway and off Broadway all ever since then. He is a fixture of our theater. He is what I call a Broadway legacy. I am so proud to know the people that I know who know him. I don't know him that well. Hopefully after tonight, both of them want to speak to me more. You never know, you know. but the two of them, Chuck Cooper and Deborah Rivoy, are just fabulous. And I welcome you to Lenny Gottfried's Straight No Chaser. Did I get some of that right, you all? Did I get some of that right?
Well, that's a lovely introduction.
Well.
Thank you so much. And we're thrilled to be here.
Oh, it's just fabulous. One of the things that I want, and you all have to switch off and figure out who's going to talk when, because I'm married also, so I'm not getting in who's going to talk where, you know. So I'm going to ask a question, and then you all take turns. But I'm going to ask you, Chuck, you first. Now, you are from Ohio, Cleveland, Ohio?
Correct, yes.
All right. And
yes,
so
or,
now,
as we used to call it, the mistake on the lake.
I was there for a wonderful production a long time ago, but it was so cold that I had to go and buy to a ski shop and buy a ski shoe so I could go to the theater. It was extremely cold, but I had a great time there. A great time. Absolutely fabulous.
Oh, good.
Your journey. How did your journey, how did you get from there to here? And now, Deborah, you be thinking, because I'm getting ready to ask you the same question. Okay.
Okay.
So.
Wow.
So, Chuck, how did you get
from Cleveland to here? It was Route 80. No. Oh, my God. How did I get? I honestly, I don't know. It was a series of serendipity and luck and good fortune. I went to college in Ohio, University in Athens, Ohio, to study to be an actor. And upon graduating from Ohio University, I decided to try my hand as an actor in New York City, and I moved to New York City in the bicentennial year of 1976, and I was lucky enough to get my Equity card in the first week I was in town, and children's theater. I've just been blessed. Clearly, the ancestors and God have been looking out for me this whole time.
I hear you. I know the relationship. I know.
And I stuck it out.
Now, when you got here, now I know a couple of people that you know, so I have to say them. I have to give them shout outs because you know I do want to live after this broadcast. So take a shout out to Dale Shields, who you know, and then did you go to school with Dale?
Oh yeah, Dale's my big brother, my older brother.
See, now I'm not getting into that. Okay, I just have to say the name so that I will be alive when this is over. So you and now the next three people have been on the show. Franz Jones. I talk to him all the time. He's my associate director. Yes, he's just the delight of my life. Jeffrey Thompson.
I love me some Franz.
I get engaged in his apartment, so, you know, he's a lifelong friend. And Gwen Gilliam, all three of them have been on the show in different kinds of ways, and some in the group, some individually, but different ways, the three of those, Jeffrey and Gwen and Franz. So I know those people that you know. And so as a result, I've heard all your business all the time.
Oh, my God. Well, only believe the good stuff.
Okay, well, you know, you must send them a check every month because they only talk really well about you, both of you.
Good.
But this is Deborah. They all make frequent appearances at the card table when there's a bid whist game going on over here, all of them.
And this I've heard about, you see, because my husband is a poker player. So when they've come to our house, they've come, you know, a couple of them have been in my house. We had not bid whist, because you all play bid whist. We had Texas Hold'em poker at the table. You know, so we have the similarities. I just watch. I'm just cute, and I sit back and I watch. I don't play, but the conversation goes on. Now I'm going to switch to you, Deborah. So tell me where you were born. I've read two or three things that say different places. One place wants to place you in one state, and the other place wants to place you in another state. Now, which state? Is it Ohio or Alaska that you were born in?
I was born in Ohio. I was raised in New Jersey. And then I moved to Alaska as a young adult and spent my most important years in Alaska. And so I say I'm from Alaska because that's the place that feels most like home to me and feels like I feel like I'm really more Alaskan in spirit than anything. But I was actually raised in Columbus, Ohio, but I left Ohio as a very young child.
So both of you are Ohioans, though, really. Oh, you, how would you say that? Do you say Ohio? How do you say it? You're from Ohio.
Buckeyes.
We're Buckeyes.
Buckeyes. Oh, okay. So both of you are Buckeyes. That's fabulous. So now I have a question. Both of you are from
Ohio. And Jeffrey
Ohio.
And Dale are Buckeyes, too.
Yes, they're Buckeyes, too. Now, what started your journey in the arts, both of you? I mean, did it start in Ohio? Did it start, you know, it started in college? Because you went to college, Chuck, in Ohio. But, Deborah, did it start in New Jersey? So both of you take turns and tell me, when did the art bug start in your life?
Well, I can go. My parents were performers in an amateur Gilbert and Sullivan opera company, and they couldn't always afford babysitters. So my brothers and I were dragged to rehearsals and to performances. So I sort of grew up in a theater environment, but it never really occurred to me that I could do it. I actually became ignited with literature when I read the poetry of Edna St. Vincent Millay at the age of 14. And at that age, I knew I wanted to be a writer. But I didn't have good grades in school, and I couldn't get into good schools. And when I finally got to college, I took some creative writing classes, and I was very strongly discouraged by my creative writing teachers, who were very harsh in their judgment of me. And in fact, they were so harsh that one of them told me to stop embarrassing myself and to stop writing, and I actually did. And to Alaska, and I decided to be a practical person, and I got a master's degree in political science. I worked in Alaska politics. Then I became an administrator at a theater company and sort of did all those things that I thought were sensible jobs that I was supposed to do until I was in my mid-30s when I had the classic midlife crisis and realized that I just really wanted to pursue this thing that I knew I was, which was a writer. And so I did everything backwards. I went to graduate school at Brown University at the age of 38. I didn't begin writing until very late. Paula Vogel gave me a fellowship to go to Brown based upon a writing exercise I had done in a workshop she led up in Alaska. And she said to me, "You're a writer and you need to take it seriously." So at the age of 38, I decided to do that. After working in the professional theater for 15 years as a producer and an actor and stage manager and doing stuff like that, I began to write. And I uprooted my life. I moved from Alaska back to the East Coast and made the commitment to doing nothing but writing. And that was in 1991. I went to school. I went to NYU after Brown, and I got training in how to write musicals. So I spent 4 years in school, and I got out of school as a MFA writer at well past the age of 40, and that's when I began my career. And so everything that I'm doing now started. I was a late bloomer. I started very late, and I did it all backwards. I went to school after I had been working in the theater for 15 years and started this second chapter of my life.
That's fabulous. And you might think backwards, but he did it forwards for you because, we all have such a unique journey. And why we take the journey that we take, that's always the universal question. But it is the journey that you needed to take in order to appreciate where you are and where you were going. Now, Chuck,
when did the bug hit me? I guess the bug hit me fairly early in some ways because my father and my mother were amateur actors in Caramel House in Cleveland.
Oh, Caramel House.
Which is one of the oldest community theaters in the country. And at a very young, I actually went to nursery school in a theater in Caramel House they had a nursery school there, a preschool.
Oh.
And
oh my God.
So I was always around the theater and you know, shows and whatnot. I remember going to see an all black production of Oklahoma when I was a little kid. Going to see a bunch of stuff. And also, as I was coming up in high school, Cleveland, you know, there's a lot of theater in Cleveland. My mother took me to see Hair when it came in town, and there's Kane Park with has a lot of summer theater, and I worked in Kane Park in the summer and squeegeed off mm-hmm. the outdoor stage and, you know, would hide in the bushes and watch the shows for free. And so I just was always around the theater, and all my friends loved the theater and were involved in theater. I never tried acting or anything until I went to college, and so that's when I really took a turn towards the theater as a vocation, as a way of life, because in my freshman orientation class, I didn't really know what I wanted to do. I kind of thought I wanted to be a disc jockey, but I knew one thing. I wanted to have fun. I knew that whatever job mm-hmm. you have, it should be something that mm-hmm. you like, because mm-hmm. I mentioned my father, you know, was an amateur actor at Caramel House, but his job was working as a porter for United Airlines. And he hated his job, hated it.
Yeah,
and that taught me that, you know, you spend an awful lot of time at work, so you really ought to find something that you like to do. And so I thought it was going to be being a disc jockey. I figured, I'll play records all day. That'll be fun. But it just so happened that the orientation of the professor or the, I guess, the faculty person in charge of my little orientation group as a freshman was the he was the professor for lighting design in the School of Theater. And, you know, you fill out this form of what your interests were. And in high school, I had fun in the choir. And it was a pretty outrageous choir. We toured the country and cut records. And I was a soloist and all kinds of stuff like that. So he suggested that I try the theater department, the freshman track in the theater department. And I thought, oh, well, that's interesting. That's fun. I know that's fun. The theater people always have fun. So I tried the freshman track, and lo and behold, I guess I had some talent or something, because I would get cast in shows and. And, you know, they didn't kick me out. And plus, it was an easy bunch of credits. You know, voice and movement. And, you know, I thought, oh, wow, you can get a college degree doing this stuff? This is great. And I went through the first 2 years. And then you had to audition to get the final 2 years was the conservatory that you had to audition for, called Studio.
Mm-hmm.
And I put my studio audition together, and I got in. And so they trained me to be a professional actor. And upon graduation, the choice back then, which I guess is pretty much the choice now, but although we have the internet and everything, it's way different. But the choice was either move to New York or move to Los Angeles. And
I
hated Los Angeles. My father lived out in Los Angeles at this time, and I spent a lot of time out in L.A., and I really did not like Los Angeles. And I didn't know anything about New York, so I figured I'll just try New York. And as I said, my father worked for United Airlines, so he gave me my last free pass to fly from Cleveland to New York, and I landed at LaGuardia Airport with all $260 in my pocket, and and began my journey to be an actor.
That's,
so,
you know, it's
that's
so kind of
how I got here.
Building the arc between the two of you, listening to your stories and some of the similarities of how you got to New York and, and Deborah, in your case, you said East Coast. It's so interesting as I try to build this arc because, of course, I'm building to the point of now you've come from college and you're starting to work. You've gotten your equity card, Chuck, very early, and so you're doing things. Now, Deborah, you're on the East Coast and you've discovered yourself as an artist. Now you're realizing that this is something that you want to pursue. Both of you deciding that this is something that you want to pursue because I believe it's a passion for you, but you had to find out a little bit. He'd take a little journey to get there. How in the world that you all come from the similar worlds at the beginning, different worlds, and now you're in the same world, how in the world did you all meet? And well, and how did that happen?
I can jump in and start the story. I wrote after I got out of graduate school, I wrote a musical called King Island Christmas that was based on an Alaskan children's story. And it got optioned by commercial producers and who made a really beautiful cast album. And we were doing readings in New York. Long story short, they kept saying, we need somebody like Chuck Cooper in this role. And so, but I didn't know who Chuck Cooper was. I just arrived in New York and I said, then we'll bring him in and we'll audition him. And they said, oh, no. You don't audition him. You offer him the part. I said, I don't know who this guy is. I said, I want to audition him. And they go, you don't audition for readings. And I said, I'm not giving the lead role to somebody I don't know. So either he auditions or we get somebody else. So they called and asked, if he would come in and audition for a reading. And his agent at the time, swore at the producers and hung up on them. And but one of my producers knew his agent and went and made a private phone call and said, look, we've got this young writer from Alaska, and she, please just have him. Can you please just send him over so she can meet him? And so Chuck then got the phone call from Monty, his agent, and said, will you, please go sing for this. There's some lady here who's got a kiddie show. Will you go support? So the day arrives and Chuck very graciously comes in to sing for the lady from Alaska with the kiddie show, which is how I had been presented. And he came in to sing. And of course he sang one bar from a song and I just raised my hand and said, that's it. I don't need to hear anymore. Thank you. And that was where we met. So I auditioned him and he got the part. And so Chuck, you can tell your side of the story now.
All right. Now, Chuck, tell me your version of what happened. Now, that's very interesting. So how did you receive being asked to audition for a reading? Okay.
Well, it was pretty much like Deb said. I get a call from my agent who has left this earth now. He's no longer with us. It was Monty Silver, and Monty Silver was an old school agent, a real no nonsense, mm-hmm. Straightforward cigar chewing guy. I mean, he didn't really smoke cigars, but he was that guy. I get a call from him. Look, Chuck, this chick from Alaska. She doesn't know who you are, and this. He said, they're paying some decent money for this album and whatnot, so. Why don't you just go in and have an interview with these people? I said, oh, well, fine, no problem. And I go in. It was at David Friedman's apartment. And all I remember was opening the door, and she was sitting on the windowsill in David's apartment. I walked in, and I was like, whoa, who is that? I was like, my goodness, let me sing for her. I didn't care about the job.
This is a good conversation. Okay, go ahead.
Mm-hmm. Well, so, you know, David takes me in and teaches me the song, and I sing a little bit. And you know, I was just quite enamored of her from the moment first time I saw her.
Oh, that's so wonderful to hear. Deborah, that's so wonderful to hear.
Yeah.
Oh.
And we've been together ever since. We made the album, and the day after the album was, we didn't date until the album was made, and the day after the album was finished recording, we went on a date. We've been together ever since. That was in 1999.
Oh, how wonderful. look at that. That's absolutely, one of my favorite producers has, we talked about you all. She saw you, not recently, but she saw the both of you. Patricia Snyder says, sends regards. She usually listens to the show. So says hello to you. What a fabulous story. And, you know, both of you have a different little spin on it, but it's just so lovely. Well, now, you know, I'm such a romantic, but I have to get to the artistic part of it. Okay. All right. Now that I found out how you all have been together, how do you, you know, you both are very, very passionate about your work. Chuck, you just finished Trouble in Mind on Broadway. Deborah, I want to ask you, I want to go back a little bit to ask you, because I've read about a lot of your plays, but I have to tell you that I'm stuck on one because I'm so impressed with the idea that you would come up with the idea of this play, and I have to ask you about it. It is The Women of Lockerbie, and I remember that whole catastrophe in 88. I remember the whole thing, but could you – this is, if I'm not right, I've been reading about it. I've not read the play yet. But the storyline of what these women did, could you just talk about it a little bit? And then, Chuck, I want you to talk a little bit about some of the Trouble in Mind and those experiences and what they mean to you. But, Deborah, can you talk about what inspired you to write about this, please?
Yeah, well, of course, I remember when the Lockerbie bombing happened. I think anybody who was alive during that time period will never forget it. It was the first terrorist attack against American interests, and it was a horrible, horrible event. But it was about 9 years after that happened. I was in New York and was watching late-night TV, Ted Koppel, and he showed a documentary on the anniversary of the crash that had been made, it was about the women both American and Scottish, whose lives had been impacted and devastated by this event. And included in this documentary was a very short segment about the Laundry Project. And I had followed the Lockerbie story, but had never heard anything about the Laundry Project. It was just one of those things that, in the chaos of what happened, got overlooked by the media. And what the Laundry Project was, in the wreckage of Pan Am 103, there were 11,000 articles of clothing that were on board that plane that were strewn across the Lockerbie landscape. And the women of Lockerbie gathered the clothing and everything because it was forensic evidence in a criminal investigation. And then when they finally realized, you know, who had brought the plane down, the government, in their infinite wisdom, was just simply going to take this stuff and incinerate it. And the women of Lockerbie recognized that for many families, these items were the only remains, because a lot of people didn't get bodies back. And so the women were able to get the clothing released to them, and then they set up a laundry project, and they laundered the clothing, and then figured out who it belonged to and returned it to the victims' families around the world. And so that was the inspiration for the play. And the play is, it's fictional, it's not documentary, but it's inspired by that event. And it's about a woman and her husband who lost their only son, who come to Lockerbie 9 years later. And the wife is roaming the hills looking for his remains. This is something that people do after these horrific events.
And she meets the women of Lockerbie, and it's the night before they're going to burn the clothes. And so the play is about the quest on the part of the women of Lockerbie to get the clothing returned to them. And it's really about responses to terrorism. It's an exploration of grief, and it's written in the form of a Greek tragedy.
My heart, when I just reading about it, my heart just, I just went, you know, out loud, the whole premise of capturing that the humanity, the great humanity from one human being to another, just being able to understand that universal pain that is experienced and making this a human effort. In other words, we're not saying, well, now we've got the evidence, let's destroy it, but saying, no, that these are people and they have left people behind. It's such a wonderful premise. So thank you.
Yeah.
Very much for doing that. Thank you, and I want to see it. Okay, I'm saying this
loud. It's my most successful play. It's done all over the world. I've had over 750 productions of it. It's translated into 9 different languages, so it's performed frequently. So you'll probably get a chance because it's performed a lot.
I often say we live in the house that Lockerbie built.
Oh well. All right, I see. Well, what about the house that things like Trouble in Mind and The Life built? How about that? You know.
Oh yeah.
Tell me.
Well, yeah, they have.
Helped a little bit, didn't it? Just a little bit. Tell me about the experiences. Those are two very different kinds of roles. I mean, you did them years apart. Tell me how you feel about doing both of those roles and the range of those roles, and talk about what Memphis, who Memphis was, and your character in Trouble in Mind. Talk about them for me, if you could, for a minute. I never get a chance to do this with people, you know, to explore their work. And so I'm just so anxious to hear what you have to say. First, talk to me about your feeling about Memphis in The Light.
Oh, my. Wow. That is, I guess it's a complicated thing. First off, I have to say that I was blessed to have met Cy Coleman and auditioned for him, and I guess I made a connection with him in that first audition, those many years ago, because that audition was for the workshop of The Life, which was 10 years prior to it being on Broadway.
Whoa.
And, for me to meet Cy Coleman was amazing, much less to be able to audition for him, much less to be chosen by him to do this part. He's a pimp, all right. He's a man who abused women and he's a pimp. So that part is a drag. That part has always been a drag. Like my signature song from that show is a song that I can't really sing anywhere. Don't take much to turn a girl into a woman is. It's not your parlor number.
Yes.
You know, I would like to have gotten a Tony Award for playing a lawyer or a doctor or just, a plumber or whatever. But mine happened to be to play a pimp. And so I threw myself into it and did the best if I knew how to be. And apparently.
I think that we have to realize that, the pimps are human too. They're three-dimensional. So I think when people first see that,
That saying, the bad guys are the most fun to play.
They have a characterization about it. Yeah, but the exploration of a character, the exploration, the being able to explore all of the dimensions of a character is what makes something come alive. So, I think, this is me speaking about how I approach things. But one of the things I will say, if the character can be lifted off the page and be given breath and given reason for being, then you make them a human being who happens to be that, and then you magnify things of why that they are that. And so that story has to be told too. Everyone has a story that has to be told, and that's how I look at it. I just, you know, when they're flat and they're just there to present some colorful background, that's when it, you know. But yours was the portrayal of, you know, a three-dimensional characterization. So I'm going to praise you for that, because, you know, we have to give credence to all human beings here and tell their story. But now we go to Trouble in Mind. Tell me
I can. I'm still humming, glowing, and buzzing from my experience and journey with that piece, because it was that rare occasion when a play meets the zeitgeist, when an author finally gets her due, and a really good piece of her work gets shown in a really good way, and I got to be a part of telling that story. And I'm so grateful for it, because it was a good ride. It was a good one.
Good.
Artistically, in terms of my fellow artists that I got to work with for the first time and meet, it's just wonderful. I'm almost speechless because of how wonderful it was.
Mm-hmm. Well, isn't that what art should do to us sometimes?
It rarely is. This is.
You're preaching to the choir about that one, but I think that that's what we speak. You know, I think that's what we speak when we go out. That this is as Bea Richards used to say when she received a script. She used to say, "Oh, I hope I want to do this." You know, those scripts that come to you with roles that you say, "Oh, this is not the one for me."
Script, I hollered out loud at some of the lines that my character had. I was like, "Oh my God, I can't believe I get to say that." Sheldon. I stepped into Sheldon. You know, and it's really funny because Sheldon is, in many ways, very different from me, and in a lot of ways, absolutely very much like me. But let me just say that I enjoyed stepping into him, and I enjoyed. My sincerest hope is that somewhere in heaven, Miss Alice Childress is pleased with what I did and what we all did. And trying to bring life to her piece. That's my hope. That's my big hope.
Well, that's fabulous. That's what we all hope when we tackle something. Now I'm going to say this: we have only about, I'd say, 17 minutes left in our discussion. Now I told you it goes fast. Okay. So I'm going to say again to anyone who wants to call in. And say anything to you, ask you any questions about your journey, ask you any questions about how art, it's obvious how the arts have influenced your lives. I mean, the arts brought you together. That's the one thing that I can, that's my interpretation of it, that it, you know, you were brought together by the arts. It's fabulous, you know. If anyone has any other questions or something that they want to say, you please dial 516-453-6063 and have people who are on the board, but they're not hitting anything. They're just listening to your story. So I'm saying to you, hit the number one. Get on the air. Ask us some questions. But until they do, and if they don't, I have some other things that I want to ask you. Given where you are now alive. Say it again.
Oh, I was just wondering, do people often call in and ask questions?
Yes, they do sometimes. Mm-hmm. Sometimes.
Uh-huh.
Not all the time. They listen a lot because this is a conversation that people don't hear a lot. A lot of people don't know your journey. They don't know how you feel about doing roles. They don't know Deborah's journey, how she, you know, how she interpreted that play. It's a different point of view. But every once in a while, I'll get somebody, you know, that'll call in and ask a question about a piece that they've seen or anything like that. Not that often, but it does. And it adds a nice dimension to the show because then you hear another voice hearing what you've talked about. And so I encourage that to people. But sometimes I think I scare them away. I don't know. They just want to hear what we have to say. But I'll continue this by where you are in your lives now. I mean, you've really reached some really wonderful peaks in your life. What is it that you want to do now? You know, as a unit, as two separate people, what have you thought about? What you want to accomplish next? Not your whole full goal, because that's a whole nother hour of conversation. But what you might want to accomplish next, Deborah? I'm gonna go to you. Think, Chuck.
Well, I mean, I think I want to keep doing what I'm doing because I enjoy it so much. I'm writing a lot of opera now, and I'm really enjoying that. I haven't made the switch because I still write plays and I still write musicals, but I have about 7 projects, you know, that I still want to write and that I'm have underway. So I want to keep doing that. We bought a lake house, and we are spending all of our time out in the lake house. So I'm kind of slowing down in terms of some things, but slowing down for me is hanging out at the lake and doing lots of writing. And so that and a little bit of travel in our future. And that's what I want to do.
Okay. All right. That makes sense. Would you say, you've got projects, are most of them operas and not plays now, or are you
well, I have I have an opera that was just made into a movie, and then that's going to go to Cincinnati next year. I have another opera opening in Chicago. I have a play that's just been optioned for the West End and for Broadway, so I'm in rehearsals for that. I'm writing a musical about the Loving Story with Deidre Murray, and that's being commissioned, but I'm not allowed to announce by who yet, but we're in negotiations for that. So I've got a lot of projects that are in the works. I have another new opera that I'm working on. So I have a lot of projects that I'm working on, and that's what I enjoy most. I was doing a lot of teaching. I was doing the equivalent of 2 full-time teaching jobs. I just quit one of my teaching jobs. And I imagine I'll start pulling back a little bit on teaching because the writing is becoming, you know, very time-consuming.
Before I go to Chuck and ask him this, talk to me because I am I'm probably a what do they call it a person that I'm addicted to probably education. I always wanted to be a teacher, so. But it didn't happen, you know. My journey took me to another place. And what did you feel about teaching? How did you feel about teaching before, you know, I just want to get that in for a second. How did you feel?
I love to teach. And I teach at NYU and Columbia University.
and I'm teaching in their MFA program. So I'm teaching, you know, like the best students. I mean, they're very competitive programs. So the students there are wildly talented, and I have wonderful relationships with the faculty, and I love teaching there. I used to teach at Goddard College. I just resigned from there. You know, but I'm maintaining my teaching job on an adjunct basis, which is, you know, how I'm able to have a career and also teach. But I love teaching. I love teaching.
I'm a closet teacher. I guess I'm a closet teacher. That's what I guess I am. Things that I get a chance to do it when I direct. You know, directing for me is a kind of a vehicle like that, because I found it into making it lessons for the people who need to have some enhancement. So I was just curious about that. Well, that sounds like a full play to me. So, and I still have to find your play and see it, and I will, you know. I'm sure it'll be done somewhere. I will. Now, Chuck, what are your thoughts of the future? What are your thoughts of the future?
I want to go fishing. I only work to buy bait. Yeah, that's the short answer. The long answer is I guess I've been collecting my pension now for about a year, about something around that. And I survived I dodged all the slings and arrows and made it to a place where I have a pension. And lo and behold, I'm not rich, but you know, I'm okay. And we're okay. And so I don't have to work anymore. And my whole life I've had to, any job that came along, I had to take it. You know, occasionally I would say no, but very rarely did I say no. Now I say no. And I love it. I love it. Okay. Now I only do what I really, really, really want to do, or I can do nothing at all. And I'm really okay with that.
Okay. Well, one day I hope to be, you know, with both of you doing a project. That's what I hope. I hope that the
well, Deb just wrote a play for me. It's fabulous, and we're gonna get it workshopped and probably bring it to Broadway in about a couple of years.
That's fabulous. You know, I feel a similar feeling about. I think I've been blessed a lot in that I have been on a journey where I could say no for a very long time, and.
Oh, great.
And that, being able to do that, though, gives you a responsibility for those people who could not say no. So I've always been aware that there are people who want to say no but could not. And I always
You're absolutely right.
that, you know, that's the position that, you know, we're talking about is a gift. It's really a wonderful gift. And it should be treasured, because a lot of people may never, ever get it. Sometimes you get it at a certain point in time in your life. Sometimes you never get it. And and with it, though, it's come some of the words that I remember when studying in college. Again, studying to be an actor. And it was that, it's like, is this going to get me a degree? Am I going to do this and be, you know, get this, do this and get a degree? But being mentored by the brilliant Lloyd Richards, and him saying to me, if you do not see what you like, then you create it. And that's what keeps me going all the time, because there are things that I'd like to see. I'd like to see me a little bit more, you know. I ask him, don't you get tired of not seeing yourself? Don't you get tired of not seeing yourself? I don't see me enough. And so I want to inspire people like you to think about that there are people who are not seen a lot, that they need people like you to expose that. because there are other voices that need to be heard. And I'm a believer that this is the universe. Everybody needs to be heard. But I have, you know, I've taken us down another road that I shouldn't do at all. And that's my fault. You know, I shouldn't have done that at all because this is supposed to be about y'all and not about my thoughts. Okay. So I will end this, you know, in the last 5-6 minutes, because that's all we really have. Talking about really what you want to see, what you want the business to be like. All right, if you had a projection, what do you want the business to be like? I'm so sorry. I'm thinking that no one should be able to come in here, but they are at one point. What would you like the business to be?
Let me rephrase your question and make the question: What is it that I would like to do? What projects would I be interested in doing?
All right. Besides fishing, thank you. Oh, what is this? You know, I'm so sorry. I just have to. Usually, I don't. Everyone is aware of what I'm doing here, and I don't know why this is happening, but it is happening. So, I'm going to continue now. Now, besides fishing, what are you thinking about?
I got to say, my feelings are a little hurt about how you minimizing my fishing, because fishing is important.
No. No, I'm not minimizing
but,
your fishing. Let me just
but, I, but I'm here. You say you want me to talk about something other than fishing.
No. Yeah.
All right.
I come from a family of fishermen, and so you know my family's from Florida, so I come from a family of fishermen, and I know how important that is when that is something to you. So I'm not minimizing it. No. Forgive
me
then.
All right.
If I get that impression.
Okay.
No.
So what do I want to do?
But.
I want to do this play that my wife wrote for me because it's really a great play. And it's called The Drolls. And it would be fun. I would like to do that. You know, there's some classic roles that I would still like to do. I would like to do a Lear. There's a bunch of August Wilson that I would still be into doing. I'm a sucker for doing Shakespeare. Some nice limited run theater projects on Broadway would be nice. Television and film, I mean, that would be great to make some money, but you know, I've thrown lots of spaghetti at that wall and none of it stuck, so that's okay. I'm okay with where I am right this minute. I am really, really, really okay.
I would like to respond
to something you said. Basically, you said to those to whom much has been given, much is expected. And I do feel the need to find a way to give back in some way. I'm working on the board of a children's theater company now and realizing that is a way that I can do that. And I need to pay it forward. And that is something that is going to be in my focus as I go forward.
Well, I think we are on the same page there. Yeah, we're on the same page there. I find that there is a great need for me to recognize how blessed I've been and to try to pass it back or forward to people who may benefit from it. So, yes.
Right.
That, you know, and you know, Deborah, I know you said you've had your projects, but what, in these last few minutes, I'm trying to squeeze this in now before, but what you have, you, Chuck, you have a daughter that's in the business, very talented, and she's been nominated for a Tony. What would you like the business to be for her?
Well, I mean, I would, well, first of all, I have to say I'm not her mom. I'm her stepmom, so I can't take that credit. But, you know, and she's off on a great career. But, I mean, what I would like to see the theater be, you know, I'm very aware of the gender bias and how difficult it has been and how difficult it continues to be for women to have a career. It's much, much harder. And so I would like to, you know, part of a group called 50-50 by 2020, which is gender parity by 2020. Well, obviously we didn't get there. We're making gains.
Yeah.
So what I would like to see a more inclusive theater. And I think that, you know, for me, the first issue is women, because women are always underrepresented, and I would also like to see greater diversity in of stories that are told on the stage. So as we, you know, and I'm thinking that, you know, certainly the Black Lives Matter movement has really increased the awareness on a lot of theater companies' parts, and they seem to be making a greater effort towards diversity. We'll see if that lasts. I'm always suspicious about that stuff, but
yes,
but, you know, the signs are good so far. I hope it continues.
Mm-hmm.
And so I would just like to see more opportunities for women and people of color in the theater.
Mm-hmm. Well, I thank you. Chuck, do you have any comment to say in the last couple of minutes on that?
No, I think I'm good. Like I said, everything I wanted to say.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, you know, we're down to the last. I just want to get you all. We're down to the last 2 minutes of the show. So I'm going to say to people that as you can see now, these guests have been very, very entertaining and fabulous for this hour. And we're going to hopefully sit 10 more minutes with me on video, so you all can see who you've been hearing. And I thank them both for being such wonderful, wonderful guests and having such fun with me and making this fun tonight. Next week, I will have the wonderful interviewer, Annette Isdorf, coming in. She interviews everyone all over the world and currently has been doing things at the 92nd Street Y. But tonight, I want to thank you two so much for saying yes to a person that you really don't know and being so candid and so wonderful, you know, in your answers. Thank you. And I will see you in a few minutes on the video, but I'm going to end this right now. And you have 90 seconds and say thank you. And I'll see you on the video. All right, the two of you?
It's great talking
all right.
to you. Really enjoyed it. We'll see you in a few.
Okay, see you in a little bit.
Okay.
Talk to
okay.
you
in a little bit.
Thank you, everyone, for listening to Lenny Gossett's Straight No Chaser. And we'll hear you and see you on the radio. See you on the radio.
This is something we all know. Fever isn't such a new thing. Fever started long ago. Never know how much I love you. You never know how much I care. When you put your arms around me, I get a feeling that's too hard to bear. You give me fever. When you kiss me, fever, when you hold me tight, fever, in the morning, fever all through the night.